Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Andrew Walker, media mogul, host of the Yet Another Value podcast, writer on Yet Another Value blog, general OG of the media space, as far as I'm concerned, and like a very good guy. I've gotten to know Andrew. We did the Bob Rabati thing at Markel. Had a good time together. At least I had a good time. I'd like to think he had a good time. He said yes to coming on the podcast, so you'd think he had a good time, but who knows? Maybe he just likes the exposure. Anyway, I digress. It doesn't matter. Thank you all for listening, as always. This episode is sponsored by DeLupa. DeLupa's great. I use it. I've been getting all kinds of emails. I've got emails here on Google, Microsoft, all types of things. It's telling me that the models are updated. I click on the email, and here we got Netflix. And then it'll say, hey, sheet 1, row 921, contribution profit is updated. 922, operating income's updated. Then I click see my models. I got the whole model right in front of me. It's a very good product. I highly recommend you checking it out. The official read is, DeLupa is founded by a former hedge fund analyst to bring simplicity into the investment process. DeLupa offers AI-driven single source for all company reported data and allows for investment teams to make the most informed decisions in the shortest amount of time. DeLupa scales the velocity of an investment team's idea gen. Analysts spend less time locating and manually inputting meaningful disclosures into Excel and more time synthesizing in the minutes after the print. DeLupa captures data from all company reported sources, including from footnotes, MD&As, and investor presentations. DeLupa's data sheets include gap to non-gap adjustments, guidance, and all company-specific KPIs. Each data point is auditable to the source for easy verification and accuracy. DeLupa's Excel plugin can also update your existing models for the latest quarter in just a single click. Bulge bracket banks and major multi-managers are trusting DeLupa for use in initiating coverage, building and maintaining industry dashboards, and keeping their models up to date. Visit DeLupa.com/businessbrew to create a free account and learn more about how DeLupa can help increase your team's speed to differentiated insight. They don't say it here, but it is possible that DeLupa makes you the greatest analyst ever. I don't know. They're not going to say it. I'm going to say maybe it'll happen. Maybe it won't. Who knows? That's probably on you. But can't hurt. Anyway, nothing in this program is investment advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. This is Andrew and I just shooting the shit. I hope you enjoy it. And always consult a financial advisor before making investment decisions. Do your own due diligence. Enjoy the episode. I'm off for a couple weeks after this, probably about a month. Thank you as always and enjoy the episode. Okay, bye. Ladies and gentlemen, return from Andrew Walker, the arguably the best interviewer for single ideas in the podcast space. I can't say the best podcaster because I have endowment bias, but alas, one of my favorite podcasters.
You know, who else does single stock investment interviews? There aren't too many.
No one like you.
That's true. I like that.
Yeah, you're like, we're like the Car Awards, right? So you're the best single stock podcaster in the space.
It sounds like you're at the end of the year of summer camp. It's like, we got to give every kid an award. He's the best single stock guy. He's the best thematic guy. We're just really hitting the end of the barrel.
Well, I think that what you do takes real skill. I had Fairfax as a pitch that came out today, and I don't think that I pushed back enough. I appreciate how quickly you're able to go through an idea, find the pushback, and how you do. You don't let people come on and just pitch something. And I appreciate that. I think it does a service to everyone in the ecosystem.
Thanks, man. You know, for me, it's just the podcast is a labor of love and a lot of time. But the way I kind of make it work for me is I'm like, look, I have a smart guy. He's coming on. He's obviously got money or his reputation or some combination of the two behind the idea. And I just want to use the idea to the best of his and my time where I'm like, if this is a good idea, I want to know. I want him to answer all my questions. So if I really like it, I can put money behind it. Or if I don't, I can, you know, I've spent a half day and I can put it on the pass list or kind of keep following it until it hits a point where I can make an investment.
Yeah. It's a smart way to build a lead gen funnel, for lack of a better term.
That's the hope.
Yeah. I need to stop saying when I speak, but I digress. Anyway,
since I got the podcast, that's been a major focus of mine, and I've been working on it for 2 years. And I have not been able to solve it. But now when I listen to really good podcasters, or especially people on network TV, and you hear how cleanly they speak, I'm really impressed by it. You don't realize what a skill it is until you actually start paying attention.
Yes, especially the live people.
Yep.
Yeah. It's very hard to think and keep a conversation going and not have those sounds. So I agree with you. I respect what they do. You want to start with your Microsoft thing that came out today? Or what did you call it in the article?
I called it Mega Hard as the inverse of Microsoft. Yeah, so for those who don't know,
Mega Hard, I like that.
I write a blog, getanothervalueblog.com, and whenever I'm thinking about something, I generally tend to write it and type it up. It's really helpful for me for investing, thinking through all areas of investing. Today, I was just like, I was actually prepping for this podcast, and I was thinking, what do people talk about a lot on Bill's podcast and in Bill's circle? And one of them was Microsoft. And, you know, everyone knows this year has been dominated by, I think it's called the Magnificent Seven now. And I was thinking a lot about people's historical track record. And Microsoft's one of the Magnificent Seven. I know a lot of people who have built fantastic track records on, they bought Microsoft 10 years ago when Microsoft was trading for 10 times price to earnings. And it probably had 30% of its stock price in cash, maybe 20%, whatever. I can't remember the exact. And they've rode it all the way to today, where today it trades for 35 times price to earnings and a huge multiple. And they've had a 10 bagger in 10 years in a mega cap. And I was just kind of thinking about it. I was like, look, the people who identified it, A, great for them. They can just say scoreboard and walk away, because that's all that really matters in investing. But, you know, if I had told you, if I did the reverse, I called it the Benjamin Button, right? And you and I were talking today. I said, hey, there's this great stock. It's trading for 35 times price to earnings. It's got all these AI plays and everything. And then 2 years from now, you and I were talking. I said, well, you know, the AI thing didn't play out, but now it trades for 20 earnings. And these are really nice businesses. And then 2 years, you and I were talking. I said, oh, you know, the businesses are kind of in terminal decline, but now it's only 10 times price to earnings and it's got a lot of cash flow. You would say, oh my God, complete thesis drift. Andrew has lost his mind. He can't admit he had a loser. He's made a mistake. Because Microsoft's gone the other way, right? It started at 10 times price to earnings with a lot of cash. Then it went to 20 times and had good businesses. And now it's like this world dominant business at 35 times. Nobody accuses those people of having thesis drift. But I do wonder, like, how much was it luck? You know, Microsoft's kind of an N of one. How much was it luck? How much was it skill? It's kind of strange to me that the people who were identifying Microsoft as a value at 10 times price earnings were also the right people to hold it when it was at 20 times and starting to become a great, great business, and are also the right people to hold it now when it's at like 35 times earnings and people think it's the best business in the world. So I don't know. I think about those type of hypotheticals all the time. And investing is a hard game to judge skill and luck. So I don't know where I'm going with it.
Yeah. No, man. I understand. I think that some of the answer has come from Buffett saying, you know, just hold. And I think that there's some wisdom in that. But I tend to agree with you. It's something I struggle with a lot. I mean, I was looking at Garrett Motion recently.
Oh, I know Garrett Motion. You know, I heard your interview with Dave, and Dave kind of admitted he got the idea from me. Not as much as I would have liked, but it's okay.
There you go. So, okay. So, you know, they're guiding to, what did they say in their deck? I don't know exactly. Do check the deck for yourself, but
have you looked at the new Finn spinoff?
Mm-mm.
PHIN. It's Finia. Somebody pitches a, it's spun off from Borg Warner. And if you think Garrett's cheap, Finn is really cheap, and it's got, you know, it's a different business, but it's got all the same dynamics, legacy automakers and stuff. But anyway, I cut you off, Garrett.
No, yeah. So, I mean, you know, you've got a business that appears to be transitioning to, they are winning some content in EVs. It appears as though some of the technology, technological competence translates. EV is roughly $3 billion. They're guiding to $315 million to $415 million in free cash. I mean, that's a double-digit unlevered free cash flow yield to the enterprise. You know, does that do better than something? I mean, I bring it up a lot. Part of it's to remind myself I'm an idiot for selling it. Part of it's to really think about it. But, you know, you look at something like TransDigm, I think they're doing, you know, this is backwards looking. I'm sure it'll go up, but they're doing $1 billion in free cash and it's trading for a $60 billion enterprise value. What does better from here, right? I think that's the hard thing about the game.
Well, everything is opportunity cost, right? That's the tough thing. And this is the old Charlie Munger, like you're in a horse race with odds, right? TransDigm, everybody knows this is one of the biggest and best workhorses out there, but it's trading for a pretty lofty multiple. Whereas Garrett, everybody knows the future is questionable because it might go away, but it's trading for a huge free cash flow yield. And this deal, it doesn't take much for it to go right. You know, Microsoft, the interesting combo was it traded for a nice free cash flow yield and it had all these engineers and a pretty capital light business model. Like it, one thing went right and boom, the whole thing went crazy. I don't know. It's just tough. One that I guess two things. You mentioned when you started there, you said Buffett taught everyone to hold. And one thing I think that's interesting with Microsoft is around the time a lot of people were making this Microsoft investment, IBM was trading for very much the same multiple. And I think at the time, a lot of people would have thought IBM was maybe not a better business in terms of capital light, but it had less terminal value questions. It had a better manager. You know, Satya was not running Microsoft at the time. Steve Ballmer was. IBM had their famous roadmap. There were no capital allocation questions. And Buffett was involved there, right? Yeah. And you don't hear anybody saying, like, beating the drums, I've held IBM for 10 years because IBM's stock is flat over 10 years, right? But if you were kind of doing the just hold thing, IBM would have gone really poorly for you.
Yeah. What have the underlying business results done in IBM?
I don't think well. It's tough because they've done spinoffs and they've done mergers and stuff. But when you say the stock's been flat for 10 years and it started at like a 10 times price to earnings, it doesn't take much to say, hey, it really hasn't done well, right?
Yeah, but very unlikely that the underlying business has crushed it.
But, you know, people knew there were going to be challenges. I don't think people thought IBM was terminally challenged at the time. A lot of people thought Microsoft was terminally challenged at the time. And I don't know, I guess going back to the Megahard thing, like, if you were buying at 10 times earnings back then, you weren't doing it because you believed in the cloud computing division and you weren't doing it because of this AI story. You were just doing it because most people thought, hey, people think Windows is going to go in terminal decline. I kind of think the decline will be slower, or maybe like there's going to be a PC business and Windows will keep a piece of it. You weren't today, and starting in 2017, you were underwriting all of those other things. And it just shocks me that the people who did the original could be the people who could underwrite that.
Yeah. Well, they may not have, but then they may have been smart enough to say, well, the CEO figured out something and I'm just going to ride this trend.
True. But again, it comes to, I don't know, all of investing is like finding what your edge is. And I hate to keep harping on the Microsoft story, but you were investing in 2012 because the thesis I saw at least were this company is underrated, right? Windows has longer legs than anyone believes. Excel is going to be in every business forever, basically. And yeah, Steve Ballmer sucks, but hopefully he can get replaced at some point. By 2017, you were investing on, hey, this cloud computing stuff, like this is the future. It's going to be so fast growing. I think Satya is great. Like those are two very different skill sets.
Yeah. Yeah, they are.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's just another thing you mentioned, TransDigm. You know, one that really interests me is just sticking on the story. Now, the people here know what they're getting into, but Constellation Software, I'm sure you've looked at that at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just one that really interests me because this is a business, people think it's like the next Berkshire, right? It is very acquisition driven. And they just did that deal with ICE and everything that looks like a fantastic business. But it's one that, you know, it has been priced to me for the past 2-3 years. It's been priced like that great workhorse, you know, like the largest, best horse that Charlie Munger would refer to. And it's still done really well, but it's just really hard from this multiple for me to look at and say, hey, they can go on like accretively buying their way into growth. It's hard for me to see how it does well, but people have done fantastic on it. It's just a mystery to me. It's hard to underwrite acquisitive growth for a company that size, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think you just got to get comfortable with owning the organic business, and then any acquisitions you hope are sort of the cherry on top. I don't know what, I mean, my estimates may be off, but what it looks like, it's trading a little bit under a 5% free cash flow yield 2 years out. I don't know, man. It can work.
Interest rates aren't zero anymore, though, right? Like 2 years ago, that would be fine. Interest rates are zero. But if you're underwriting 5% free cash flow yield 2 years out, right? So you're saying it's like 2 or 3% today. Cool. I could get more than that buying bonds. So I've got to overcome over the next 2 years a 2 or 3% deficit in cash flow. And then from there, I've got to grow faster. And there are business risks too, you know? So I don't know. It's not to pick on Constellation. That's just one I always look at. And maybe it's just because I've missed it and never owned it. But I always look at it, I'm like, one day it seems like it's going to get too expensive, or they won't be able to acquire this much profitably and people are going to have issues.
I think that everything that you're saying is not only correct, but what makes the game really tough, right? And I think that's why the old, you know, if it were easy, everybody that just looked at history would get rich. And that's why I think, you know, a guy like Toby just ends up he ends up a quant that's playing the value factor, because he would make all the same arguments that you are, right? He's saying like all of the great businesses eventually trade at these, well, I don't know that he would say that, but on average, you look at the high multiple bucket, it reflects a lot of positivity, and that usually, as a group, disappoints.
You know, it's funny because over the past five or 10 years, it's only disappointed once, right? 2022, it really disappointed. And I feel like at the end of 2022, people were like, meme stocks dead, growth investing dead, values back because energy and all this stuff. And then you and I are talking mid-July 2023, it's like completely the opposite, right? Nobody wants to talk value anymore. Everything growth and tech is flying. It's just funny how quickly people have forgotten how rough 2022 was and how quickly these things can turn.
I like the concept of the market exists to humiliate the most amount of people possible.
Well, you know, 2022, I think it humiliated a lot of people. But yeah, 2023, it's humiliating all the people who are laughing at 2022.
That's right. I mean, I had a friend who said he's a growthy type guy. And he said every time that value investors get really loud and start making fun of growth, that's the time that growth is about to take off. And that was last year. And I thought, I don't know, this time might be different. And here we are.
It's a good point. It's the end of 2022. I mean, you would see the guys who had made a killing in energy and commodities and stuff. And yeah, you're exactly right. They'd be like, oh, these dummies, they were buying Apple at 25 times earnings. No company can sustain 25 times earnings. And yeah, the energy stuff's done poorly. And Apple's up, what, 40% year to date, maybe more?
Yeah. Have you looked at Tyson Foods at all?
I only that their CFO was the son of the CEO, and he got caught drunk driving, and
that's just family stuff down south.
Yeah, true, you know, I'm from New Orleans. I know you're from Florida. Maybe Florida, it's more.
Chicken country. That's not well. And now it's pork and beef and whatever.
I know chicken prices and egg prices went parabolic, but not too much.
It reminds me of when oil was sort of, I think buying those kind of businesses on cheap price to book and then selling them on earnings is a mental model that makes sense to me. I don't own it. I'm not like doing a ton of work, but it kind of reminds me of oil when oil was really cheap and, you know, people were pitching it on a price to book basis. Now everybody's saying it's cheap on earnings. That always makes me super nervous.
I definitely hear, I'm still pretty bullish energy companies in general. You know, I think if you looked back to last June, most energy company stocks have not fallen that hard, despite oil going from 100 to 70. And obviously, there's an oil curve and everything. And nat gas went from 9 to 3. And it's because last June, like all the energy company stocks were not pricing in where the commodities were. And today, you know, WTI is at like 75 and the curve's probably going down to 65. And I still think a lot of these energy companies are pricing in like a 55 to 60 energy curve. And there are lots of questions, right? Like a company, these energy companies have proven time and time again, their cash flows can go in a lot of weird ways, right? A lot of them like to go drill holes that turn out to be dry, or they like to go on really bad M&A sprees. But if you just look at these companies, like I do think there's a pretty big margin of safety built in, just in terms commodity prices could go down 10%, and it's already more than reflected in what I'm seeing in a lot of their share prices, at least.
You had pitched at the Rabati event Delek, right?
I love Delek. Yeah, that's my largest position.
What do you love so much about it? So, do you love it more than you love Charter at your peak Charter love?
You know, I don't think I've ever sold a share of Charter, so I don't know. Charter is one, like, when people, when we talked about Microsoft and holding it in lessons from 2022, it's one I really regret because it came into 2022 at 750 or 800 per share, right? And I was not here saying, hey, you're going to do incredible returns with Charter at 750 or 800 per share. I thought you would do okay returns, but you know, if you sell and your cost basis is about 300, you're going to take tax consequences. And then I was kind of like, hey, you know, these are, interest rates are still zero. These are growthy businesses. I love, you know, I think financially minded people can get really in love with levered return of capital stories, which Charter was. And I said, hey, there's a lot of growth. I think they're going to win in mobile. I think they can expand homes. Like, it's just tough for me to sell when it's at 800 and I think fair value's 1,000 and maybe there's some mobile business penetration and stuff to go. So anyway, that's Charter. Delek is a refiner. They own four refineries that are kind of meh refineries in Western Texas, PADD 3. And the thesis here is twofold for me. A, I think the United States is short refining. You know, this is the Bob Robotti. We have not invested in the infrastructure type assets in the United States in 10 years. You know, Bob has played it spectacularly through Tidewater, which just absolutely
Tidewater is ripped.
It's done really well. And, you know, the thesis there was, hey, we haven't built a new support vessel in 10 years. And a lot of the old support vessels have retired and we're starting to have an energy cycle and these prices are going to go parabolic. It's a really tight market and it's played out spectacularly. But for Delek, the Tidewater story plays for a lot of energy infrastructure. And for Delek, their refiner, we haven't built a new refiner in the United States since I think the last one was 1979. We'll never build another new refiner in the United States again. How have we managed without a new refiner? Well, old refineries, you can brownfield on them and make expansions, and cars have gotten more gas efficient over time and all this sort of stuff. So we've kind of muddied along. But to me, what happened in 2020, a lot of very old refiners, when oil prices went negative and people stopped driving for a summer because of COVID, a lot of old refiners shut down, never to be opened again, or a lot of old refiners have converted to kind of greener renewable diesel type plays. So we've seen a lot of supply coming offline, but demand, miles driven, gallons demanded, all that has basically been flat over the past 5 years, ex COVID. You know, it's not growing because EVs are taking an increasing share, but it's not shrinking either. Maybe one day in the future it will, but I think that's a long way away. So because of that, you've got stable to declining supply, very stable demand. I think refining margins are kind of higher for longer than they historically have been. But the trick with Delek to me is, even if you price in mid-cycle margins, I think they would be very cheap. And then the other thing is, in 2012, all these refiners, because there's huge infrastructure assets, pipelines to get oil to the refiners, pipeline to get the gas from the refiners to wherever they're going, all these refiners started doing MLPs because dividend growth was a craze and people would buy these things at crazy multiples for dividend growth. All the MLPs have been, because of tax changes and because people don't care about dividend growth and because a lot of refiners got in trouble in the kind of oil bust in 2016, the MLPs have traded like shit, to be honest with you.
And yeah, they have.
Delek has one of the last publicly traded MLPs. And if you look at their price, Delek Logistic trades for about $50 per share. Delek owns about 80% of it. Delek stock is $25 per share, and their ownership of Delek Logistics would be about $27 per share of Delek. So they're trading underneath the value of their Delek Logistics piece. And then everything I mentioned about the refiner and the profits and everything would basically be for free. So I can talk about endless amounts on Delek.
Why is this thing so cheap? Like, okay, what do people hate about it?
So there's two things. A, you know, if you talk to Delek management, I think they would say, hey, because we own 80% of Delek, we have to consolidate Delek Logistics. And a lot of times when I'll talk to people and I'll pitch them the story and I'll say, hey, Delek has no net debt. You know, they've got this thing. It's a great story. The first thing they'll email me and they'll say, hey, I looked at Bloomberg and Delek's got a lot of debt. I thought you said they didn't have any debt. And I'll say, they don't have debt. Delek Logistics has debt. It's not recourse to Delek, but it shows up on Bloomberg. So I think Delek's management team thinks that that's a big issue.
How real do you think that is?
It's tough. I've always been quite skeptical of the, hey, our accounting's complex, so we don't screen well. I've always been pretty skeptical of it, but I will tell you, I've been pitching Delek for about a year, and the number of times I go through the story, and then the first response is, why do they have so much debt? it has been shocking to me.
I ask because I'm watching Digital Bridge go through the opposite, right? Yeah. They're selling down to deconsolidate so that they can be a pure play asset manager. And there's a part of me that hates that because I'm like, you should do what's the most economically advantageous. And then there's the other part of me that's like, I actually kind of understand why you would do this, even though it upsets me to say that.
I try not to read a lot of sell side research, but a lot of the sell side research on Delek will, you'll see, hey, we derive a $25 per share price, and we do that by taking the fair value of our three things. The first thing is we do a sum of the parts, and that comes out with $40 per share for Delek. And then the second thing is we slice an EV to EBITDA multiple on Delek, and that comes out with $20 per share or something. And I'll be like, you can't put an EV to EBITDA multiple on it because they'll consolidate all of Delek Logistics debt. And I'll just go crazy on all this type of stuff. But, you know, it's how people are doing it. I've always been skeptical, but the longer I've looked at Delek and just like been beating my head against it, the more I've thought maybe they're right. But the other thing is Delek has said they're going to split off Delek Logistics, right? The reason I got interested in the story, I followed it for years. I've got blog posts from 2018 on the blog. In June, they hired a new CEO. And in July, they came out with a investment deck, the first deck after they hired the CEO. And page one of the deck says, we are Delek, right? Page two says, new CEO's priority.
And this is new Delek.
page two says, new CEO's priority. And the first priority up there is realize the sum of the parts value. And I said, oh, that's really interesting. Because if you went back to their May presentation from the old CEO, sum of the parts value was not mentioned once in it. I said, oh, this is a CEO who's extremely serious about realizing the sum of the parts value. So that's kind of where I got interested. And the market is very skeptical that Delek can realize the sum of the parts value. They're very skeptical of realizing Delek Logistics, either because they believe, one, Delek is lying. Two, the trend for MLPs has been for the refiner to buy out the minority in the MLP. And this, me and a lot of other investors have actually done really well buying kind of sub MLP positions when the majority shareholder wants to buy it because they own 90% of it and they generally give a bump. So a lot of people are worried Delek will go buy Delek Logistics and kind of reverse the sum of the parts, right? Three, Delek's tax basis, a spinoff of an MLP is generally going to be a little funky on taxes. So people are worried there's going to be a huge tax drag. And then four, people just skeptical that they're going to do it. I hear all those arguments. I think every argument is either misguided or very solvable, but I do hear all of those arguments. So I think those are the four things. But to me, you've got a business trading below Delek Logistics value. The core refining business is absolutely minting money. And refiners have in general gotten the memo, hey, buy back shares. Nobody cares about you. Buy back shares. And Delek isn't as good as like a Marathon, who's the best in the business at it, but Delek is minting cash flow and they are buying back shares very aggressively. And one way I framed it that I think some people have liked is if you look at Delek, if you look at the dividends they get from Delek Logistics, that's like they get $2 plus per share in dividends from Delek. So today it trades for 25. You're buying it at like a 12x multiple of the dividends from Delek Logistics, and then you get everything else for free. I know price to subsidiary level dividends is not a metric, but I've also never seen a price to subsidiary level dividend like that.
It's like Big Larry Holdings, man, from that Cracker Barrel money.
Well, you know, Big Larry
Holdings. I'm not saying it's the same thing. I'm not saying
Big Larry Holdings is one that I choose not to talk about much because you can get hit with a lawsuit real fast there, but I do understand what you're saying.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, it does screen with a lot of debt.
It's got no debt. The other thing is, this is probably too much. Refiner has a lot of working capital, so they tend to keep a lot of cash and like a working capital line, but you can net them out and stuff. But yeah, the holding company has basically no net debt, and they're going to screen with, I'm sure you're looking at Bloomberg or Looper or whatever it is. They tell me if I'm wrong. They have over $2 billion of debt when you look at them.
Yep.
2.9. That's because they consolidate Delek Logistics, which is where all the debt is. And Delek Logistics is an MLP. These are very stable businesses that can and should run with 3 to 4, maybe 5, if you're getting crazy, times leverage. That's what Delek Logistics does. It's all non-recourse to Delek.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, I have thought that understanding, I mean, this is maybe a silly thought, but that, you know, coming from, I banked like food companies back in the day, you know, and like, there's just those companies need a lot of debt, right? But it doesn't mean that they're over levered at all. And to your point, I mean, you got to fund working capital. What was the, there was a logistics kind, they traded like wood, blue, what was it? BXC?
BXC.
Back in the day. Did that ever work out?
Oh, that worked out fantastically. Yeah. So that is lumber distribution and warehouses.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of a sore story because Cerberus controlled them from, I think, an old restructuring or something. And Cerberus offloaded all of their stake in just an awful secondary. And we bought a pretty substantial piece of them. And then we sold it a few weeks later for a nice profit. But, you know, we patted ourselves on the back. And the last time I looked, BXC, you know, I think we sold it at like 8 or 9. And the last time I looked, yeah, BXC's at 95. Oof. So it's done fantastic. That is, you know, they call it BLDR, is another one of these lumber distributors. And it's a roll-up play. It's a regional advantage play. And they've done spectacularly. You know who's in it? Who's been a big winner?
Well, Rabati.
Of course, our boy Bob.
Yeah. Yeah, Bob pitched me on Builders and my dumbass didn't do anything with it. And he like laid it all out for me perfectly. Oh, well, whatever. What can you do? The man can lead me to water. He can't make me drink.
And that's one of the tough things about investing, you know, and it's one thing. Sometimes I'll get maybe upset. I don't know, but I'll post an idea on a blog on the blog and it'll be like 1% position. And then somebody will email me a year later and they'll be like, I made it a 50% position. And I made a fortune. Thank you. And I'll be like, gosh darn, I didn't make a fortune off that. But you know, it tends to be like Bob could lead you to water, but you had to do the work and build the conviction. Because what would happen is you'd go into you'd start getting recession fears, and the stock would announce, "Hey, inventory went up, and our debt went up a little bit, and the stock would be down 20%." And you would panic sell it, and Bob would be like, "This is a blip. I know how to handle this. Yep. My thesis is just as strong as ever." And he would be buying, and he would do way better. Or the reverse would happen, right? It would be down 20% and you'd be like, I'm going to be a value investor. It's down. It's time to buy. Panic in the streets. And Bob would say, oh, this has really broken the thesis, right? Like inventory shouldn't be building this much. Something has gone wrong here. And he would sell and you would buy. So, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I at the end of the day, I just couldn't get comfortable with their idea of what trough cash flow or EBITDA would look like. I was like, I don't see how rates are here and they're that confident. And I was wrong because I wasn't thinking of Builders. But, you know, whatever.
What kills me is 6 or 8 years ago when it was at like 7 or 8, they owned all of their warehouses and you could do the math pretty easily and see that the land that they owned alone was probably worth about the share price. But I think at the time I was like, ooh, lumber, a commodity. This is a tough business. You know, I don't know if I really want to be involved here.
Well, you got to make sure that you've got people that you trust are going to realize the value when you have these kind of plays, right? I mean, going to Delek is the example. Like somebody's got to be focused on the sum of the parts and capable of executing the plan to release the value. How's the guy compensated? Do you know off the top of your head?
They've all got shares. He's bought some shares on the open market, but it is a question, right? Another big question is, and one of the reasons I think the stock was weak is they said, hey, alongside realizing the sum of the parts plan, we think we're going to buy a refinery so that the core business will be like a little larger as a standalone. And if you are in energy or commodity land and you say we're going out to do an acquisition, people are going to shoot first and ask questions later. And they brought on a banker in September. And I read the press release. The first thing it says is he's here to help us realize the sum of the parts, to help us unlock the sum of the parts value. And then the second thing it says is M&A. And I just said, oh, Delek Logistics is worth more than Delek. All I care about is that sum of the parts. But I think a lot of people really focus on the M&A, and perhaps rightly so, right? So, but that is one of the big worries.
Yeah. Well, time will tell. But so, you know, I don't know. People need bankers. That's what happens. You want to talk about investing? Oh, first of all, closing the loop on Charter. Not horrible news. I mean, first of all, I don't want to sound like a horrible person, but the telco led.
Yeah, why don't you come out and say it, Bill? Not horrible news that AT&T's been lead poisoning communities for 50 years. Go ahead, say that. Take that stance.
But there's an interesting dynamic that worries me. If the news is too bad, I kind of worry that it creates the incentive to get like creative and do some spinco with the fiber. That's like, you know, kind of like you offload the garbage barge of liability. But there's a lot of assumptions between now and then.
So from a Charter and cable investor standpoint, I don't, you know, the lead news is devastating, but I don't think it's bad news. I guess the few things I thought.
No, I think it's a net positive for the cable companies.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. From an investor standpoint, it was interesting to me. Just like if I told you at the beginning of the year, hey, you're invested in AT&T, what's your biggest risk? You know, you would have listed a ton of risks and you would never have thought lead exposure. You know, these companies, I think they knew they had some lead, but these companies apparently don't even know how many miles of lead. And the Wall Street Journal article said, hey, we don't even like some of these things. They don't even know who owns them, right? It could be Verizon, it could be Frontier, it could be AT&T. So it's just another thing that reminds, hey, in the stock market, there's all sorts of weird left tails and everything you buy can and might go to zero at any time. But in terms of from a cable perspective, yeah, I think it's great news. All of the cable lines have been laid. The oldest cable lines would have been laid in the late 70s. That's well after lead stopped getting used. So cable certainly doesn't have this issue. From an 18th, like at best, AT&T needs to do some remediation costs and deal with regulatory headache and stuff. At worst, they're going to have to slow down their fiber overbuild. So cable's going to be monopolies in more places than they thought. It never hurts to have a distracted competitor. And then the other thing is, if they're doing remediation, if they need to dig up pipeline, like it's going to be very supportive of industry pricing because the industry has already been rational. But even more so, all of these guys are going to need to say, hey, we need cash flow to service our debt to do all this sort of stuff. So from a cable investor standpoint, I hate to say it, as you said, I hate to join you on the great, let's lead poison our employees.
No, that's not what it is. You and I cannot change the outcome of the world as it currently is. We would, neither of us would like communities to be poisoned. But given the fact that this news came out, as someone who's long cable, I was not too devastated, given that I think cable needs some ARPU help and higher rates and more liabilities.
And again, it's easy. We sit here and stare at screens all day. It's easy to forget, but distracted management, if you're AT&T, 20% of your day just went from whatever it was to dealing with politicians, regulators, your employees about these lead issues. And it's never hurts to have distracted management. The other thing I guess I'd mention is like, you know, all these stocks, and this is something I've thought about, and maybe we can talk bias at, but something I've thought about a lot recently is, hey, it sounds trite, but the best time to buy is when a company or stock is in panic. And, you know, it does strike me as Frontier, AT&T, Verizon, all of their stocks went like down 30% and then up 15%. And nobody knows the outcome of this. If you ask me to guess, I actually think the outcome is going to be much better than the average participant thinks when you hear lead exposure, just because these are very old. I think the actual exposure levels are pretty small. These are very powerful influencers, lobbyists, and all that sort of stuff. I'd be really surprised if the actual outcomes for them is a disaster. And, you know, I think there's something to be said on Monday when all these stocks were gapping down 20% because people were saying, I can't buy into this thing. Like Frontier, if it's down 30% on the news, is there a 30% of chance of bankruptcy from this? I don't know, but it's just interesting.
Yeah. So in the preparation email that you sent me, and thank you for doing that, you had mentioned that everything could be a zero.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the example that you used was First Republic. I totally agree. I had people that talked positively about it. And as a host, I did not come up with the idea of a bank run. So I failed in my part. What did that all teach you? And how have you sort of implemented, like, what are you thinking after watching that scenario?
Yeah, I guess it's just something I've learned more and more, like, the world is full of left tails. And even when you invest in something that you think is really safe, you can find yourself like staring at a zero much faster than you thought. Like I kind of first started thinking about it when I would invest in these small micro cap, like cash heavy businesses. And then all of a sudden the management team would have stolen all the cash and be like, darn it, they got me again. But yeah, First Republic, if you and I were talking January 1st and we were like, hey, what's a reasonable worst case scenario for First Republic this year? We would have said, oh, well, book value is 70. They did $8 per share last year. maybe you have a recession. Remember, a lot of their stuff was coming from wealth management and all these other things. Maybe they have a recession and earnings go to 5 or 6. Maybe in a recession, it trades to 80% of book. So maybe it trades for like, you know, $60 per share. And I think it was at 140. So that's a pretty big drawdown. But I think that would have been you and I's absolute worst case scenario, right? We would have said in a Great Depression scenario, First Republic was widely admired as one of the best businesses in the planet with the best franchise. We would have said, hey, there's 5,000 banks in America, 4,950 of them are going to fail before First Republic fails, right? So I think that's what we would have been saying, and we would have been completely wrong. The downside was, as you said, bank run, everything on the books are overstated, and this thing's a zero before you know it. And I think there are several investors who had decent positions in First Republic as a compounder, and it was a zero before they knew it.
Yeah, I think I've said it before, I'll say it again. I think the most interesting thing about First Republic that I took away is my perception of their greatest strength was the clientele that they served. And that actually became their biggest weakness, right? Because people were one, I think they were all talking to each other. Many were financially savvy. And they were just like, why? I mean, I heard it, people saying like, why are we sitting and bearing risk getting zero when we could go to risk free and get 5? And
yeah, 100%. And I don't know how to add to that. Like, it's just funny. Though I do think on the heels of it, in like late April and May, I started getting a pretty big position in banks. And I do think on the heels of it for a while, people are saying, oh, no one's going to put money into a bank again. You know, everybody's going to be in risk-free treasuries and every bank's a zero. I do think banks have a lot to contend with, you know, Silicon Valley had $40 billion of deposits pulled overnight at the height of the financial crisis. No bank saw anything like that. We're so online now, banks have to think about liquidity a lot harder. But, you know, I think it was kind of crazy in April and May when people were saying every deposit should go be in a money market account and get 5% and stuff. And like, no, people are a little lazy. They're not going to do that. B, checking accounts offer a real service. It was just kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was interesting. I know you're still spending time on banks. Are you still, do you tend to be excited about that opportunity? I know you were excited when the top during the panic, and at the Markel event, you mentioned that. So this is not revisionist history. I'm just curious how you're thinking of it now.
I was not at all excited in like when Silicon Valley failed until about late April, right? I was just like, I don't know what deposits for these things look like. Just about any bank can fail if 100% of deposits leave overnight, right? Any bank would fail on that. I didn't know what deposits look like. I didn't know what regulations, all this. And also I hadn't like really studied banks in a long time. At the end of April, I got really bullish because the stocks just kept going down, 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 down. All of them were trading below tangible book value, and all of them reported Q1 earnings. And Silicon Valley Bank happened in March, right? And all of them said, hey, Silicon Valley Bank, the week that it failed, yeah, we saw a lot of uninsured deposits leave, but after that, deposits have been stable or even increasing. So you had clarity on how bad the deposit situation was going to look. All of them were giving you, hey, here's what our net interest margins look like. In Q1, all of them gave tons more disclosure on their commercial real estate and everything, and they were still trading below tangible book. And I think it was Citizens, their CEO was at a conference and he said, look, if you look at the history of banking, if you can buy a good bank for at or under tangible book value, you're going to do really, really well. So in late April and May, I got really excited. I've swung pretty hard at it. I should have swung much harder at it. Today, you know, a lot of the banks are up like 20%. So they're still all trading for like 1.2 to 1.5 times tangible book, depending on who you're looking. And there's obviously variations around there. And I'm probably just like, meh, you know, I'm just meh here. I think there are still some that I think are interesting. One I like a lot is First Horizon, which we can talk about if you want to. There's one or two others I like. You know, at 1.1 times book, I think ROEs on these banks can be in the mid-teens. You still lay out a pretty attractive growth profile, but a lot of the panic has left and the market's come back around to these pretty quickly.
How do you think about it? You say I should have swung harder. You know, like if you do swing harder, to your point on opportunity cost, you own a bank, right? So it's not the greatest business in the world. I don't think it's as bad as people say. I think some of the narrative is because stocks haven't done well for a while.
you know, you say it's not the greatest business, but Buffett, I mean, how many times has a bank been the largest in his portfolio? And
100%, you're right. He also sold all of them, though.
He sold...
except for Bank of America, which he's saying he held because of personal reasons or whatever.
That's a good point. I don't know. They still have the Ally investment. I mean, Berkshire in the 70s wanted banking to... Berkshire was going to have a banking license, right? And then they changed it and he had to dispose of the bank. I just think banking is a... It's what? The third oldest business in the world? People have made fortunes in bankings for a long time. It's a business that will be here for a long time. I feel pretty comfortable that if you can buy a bank right and you can do good credit analysis on it, you can make a lot of money on it and you can hold a bank for a pretty good amount of time.
Okay. So you would like, I guess what I was getting at is, you know, if you swing hard at that kind of idea, if you're playing sort of the re-rating to tangible book or whatever, then you have a scenario where, you know, you're giving up potentially like your, I guess you probably wouldn't sell your Delek position, but I'm just curious how you think about when you have these, like the Twitter arb you were really big in, right?
Yeah.
How do you think about, okay, I have opportunity cost here, or this is like a special sit, and sizing that? I know there's theoretical ways to do it, but I'm curious how you do it in reality.
It's really hard. You know, I think how it is I look at this scenario, I list my, like I run pretty concentrated. So I list the 10 things that I've got. I look at my base cases, my confidence level, how big I think the range of variation is. And then I probably just like lick my finger and put it in the air, to be honest with you. But I'll give you so the banks, why I think I should have swung hard at them, right? They were all trading below tangible book value. We have 50 years of history that says if you buy a bank below tangible book value and the book is good, right? They can't have all their book in AAA mark securities that are worth zero, like the financial crisis. But if their book is good and you've done that analysis, if you're buying it below tangible book, we've got 50, maybe 500 years that's going to work out really well for you. And there was definitely a panic, right? You could see people were selling left and right, shooting first, asking questions later. And you had every insider. I've never seen insider buying like we saw in banks in April and May. And I think the combination of those three said, hey, Andrew, you swung hard, but you probably like that combination of the history, the stability of banks and the industry, and the insider buy-in says you should have swung much harder at that type of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I get that.
Yeah. So, and then First Horizon was the one I swung the hardest at, and I still got a very nice size position. But the other thing there was they were in a merger with TD Ameritrade, and the merger broke right at the height of the banking crisis, right?
So interesting.
You get this really interesting combination of forced arb selling, plus you're in a banking crisis, plus, you know, long onlys haven't been like doing the work on it because they thought TD Ameritrade was going to take it over. So a lot of people had to kind of refamiliarize themselves. And the other thing I loved about First Horizon, the TD Ameritrade deal breaks and TD Ameritrade agrees to give First Horizon hundreds of millions of dollars of break fee and capital alongside the break, right? So to me, what I had was a bank that just became, they were overcapitalized anyway because they had been in a merger agreement for 15 months and they couldn't buy back shares when all of their peers were going and buying back shares in 2022. So they were already overcapitalized, but they had 500 million more of capitalization coming in from TD. So I said, hey, this business was already overcapitalized. They've got 500 million of fresh capital. Like this is now one of the businesses, even if every other competitor is failing, they're going to be able to make it because they're so overcapitalized. And that gives them tons of optionality, right? If it's a true depression, they can tighten the storms and use this and just hold on to this capital. If this is a mild recession, they can lend into it at really attractive rates, or they could just use it to buy back shares. So I love that combination. I thought that gave you an extra margin of safety at First Horizon.
Yeah, that makes sense. I pinged you about Expedia and you said, I don't know what kind of edge I would have in that. So like when you were thinking about the banks, what kind of edge, was it just a behavioral edge, do you think that you had? Or like, how do you put what's my edge through your framework?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit behavioral edge, right? It's tough to say there's a panic, but you know a panic when you see it, when like every stock's gapping down 15% every day. And you would talk to people, I think when we were at the Robotti and Markel day, you talk to people and they'd say, hey, how can you invest in banks? Like every bank could be a zero. We're in the middle of a banking crisis. And to me, like Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic and the banks that failed, they were truly uniquely bad, right? Like they were mismanaged. They mismanaged their risk. They had more than all of their equity lost in securities that, you know, if we mark to market our book, we would have got margin called 15 times ago, whereas they could just kind of stick their head in the sand and pretend. So I thought it was actually bad actors and bad risk managers that got taken out, not an industry-wide problem. So there was the panic, there was the insider buying, and yeah, I just think it was that combination. When you would hear generalists say, I can never look at a bank, I could never invest in a bank. Well, that's a pretty good time to look at it. I remember 2021, I'm a generalist, I'll never invest in an oil company. Well, that was probably a pretty good time to look at an oil company, and same with banks earlier this year.
Yeah. What are generalists not currently looking at? That's the question for the audience. Feel free to leave comments on YouTube.
That actually is a good, now that you say it, now that you sold that idea for me, that actually is a pretty good way to play it.
Yeah, you like that?
What would generalists not invest in right now? The only thing that comes to mind is meme stocks and shitcos, and I don't think they ever would do those. Those are working pretty well right now. But yeah, I can't think of anything else that generalists are just like, I will not touch it currently.
Yeah, I don't know. I got to think. Maybe Tyson. Who knows?
Chicken.
Yeah. You
know, one interesting one, just it is something a generalist wouldn't touch. And I just raise it because it's interesting. So I really like end of one situations, right? Where there's something that's happening that's never been done before. One of them would have been Twitter last year with Elon Musk suing to break. Like there have only been in merger arb history, like 7 or 8 companies, publicly traded companies claim an MAE, right? And this was Elon Musk claiming an MAE basically because he had buyer's remorse. So I thought that was really interesting. And there were all sorts of interesting dynamics, you know, $45 billion resting on the balance sheet of one man. Like we've never seen something like that. Currently, I think there's a really interesting one, Activision Microsoft. I don't know if you've looked at this at all, but
I have a bit.
In particular, on Tuesday, I thought was, so Tuesday, July 18th, I thought there was one day where we'd never seen anything like this before. And this is what happened. Last week, the FTC sued to block the Microsoft-Activision merger. They wanted a preliminary injunction where a court would say, Microsoft, you cannot close the Activision deal. That was, the judge ruled for Microsoft. So Microsoft, from a practical perspective, U.S. regulatory risk went away. After that happened, there was only one regulatory risk left, the U.K. CMA. And on Monday, we had a court hearing in the U.K. that was unlike anything I personally have ever heard before. Because the U.K. system is different than ours, U.K. and Microsoft and the U.K. government, the CMA, the regulator there, went to the court and said, hey, judge, we have a hearing next week where Microsoft and the CMA are going to go head-to-head and say why the deal should or should not be allowed. Both of them went to the court and said, judge, would you please let us cancel this hearing because we would like to work together to get this merger done, right? I've never heard of anything like that. I don't believe the judge had ever heard of anything like that. I've never heard of anything like that. So that you've got an N of one regulatory situation. But on Tuesday in particular, you had this really interesting thing because you were only waiting on the UK CMA to approve it. We didn't know if they were going to approve it that day or night. It might close. It might not. The merger agreement might get extended, but we also didn't know if Microsoft, because the merger agreement was going to time out on Tuesday, right? So they would have to extend the agreement if they wanted the deal to go on. We didn't know if Microsoft was going to bump or not, give more consideration to Activision in return for extending the agreement. So you had all these situations we've never seen before. We're familiar with bumps for deals and we're familiar with bumps, but we've never seen Microsoft waiting on one, we've never seen a AAA buyer like Microsoft waiting on one specific regulator who has said, we want to approve this deal. We want to work with you to approve this deal. And for the whole merger arb community to say, we don't know if the deal is going to go through at 95 tonight, 95 in 2 months, or an increased price. And you saw that in the options, which the options market was absolutely insane. So, you know, if you buy, to use rough math, if a stocks is going to either close at 10 or close at zero, a $5 option should be priced at about 250. Right? So 50% it goes to 10 and you make $5, 50% it goes to zero and you make nothing. Microsoft, in this case, you could buy the 9250 calls and sell a 95 call. And it was implying like a 50% chance that this deal would close when you had the one regulator and the one holdup saying, we want to get this deal done. And that's because the 95, which is above the deal price, people didn't know how to price that. They didn't know how to do a bump or not. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. And it it still remains the strangest situation I've seen where Microsoft is Activision's trading at 92. It's a 95 deal price. And the one holdup is a regulator who says, we're just working to make sure we can approve this under our regulations. It's extremely strange. I've probably rambled and thrown a lot of terms out there. I'll let you kind of steer me to where this would make sense for your audience.
What happened with the 95s?
So the 95s, Activision on Wednesday, they came out, they extended the agreement in return for an increase in break fee in the extremely unlikely case that this deal breaks. And Activision gets to pay a 99 cent per share dividend. And the 95s have basically collapsed because here's an interesting thing. If Activision had ruled that a special dividend, the $95 strike price would drop by the amount of the special dividend. Because they declared it a regular dividend, the dividend will actually go through and the 95 strike will not adjust. So the 95s could have actually been very profitable. I know a lot of people who thought the bump should have been $3, $5, even $10 per share and thinks Activision kind of let Microsoft off easy because they want to get this done. But if it had been declared a special, the 95s would have been absolutely baller, absolutely outrageous return.
Interesting. Yeah, well, the people that bought the bull spread at least sold a worthless option in the end, right?
Well, and that's why I think
the market
was really struggling, right? You had this. Again, Microsoft, no one doubts Microsoft has the ability to close. They can find $67 billion in their couch cushions. Oh, that's one other thing why this is an end of one. It's one of the largest deals in history, right? So until a month ago, most people, including me, thought this deal was dead. The FTC was suing. The UK CMA was going to block it. They thought it was dead. All of a sudden, over the past week, you've had the FTC loses and the CMA has a change of heart. So a lot of burnt out event investors. And guess what? Event investors, people have done the math before. They probably only managed like $100 billion of capital. If you apply reasonable risk limits, like a lot of people think event investors can't even close the gap on the spread between this merger. It still looks very wide to me based on the probabilities I've laid out. But yeah, like, I think all those N of ones is why it was so interesting and why it's still pretty interesting, even though it trades decently closely to the 95 price.
I think that your comments about this deal are interesting if we tie it back to the Megahard example. I mean, what are the base rates of huge acquisitions doing well? And is it possible that with Microsoft trading at what, $2.5 trillion or whatever, or is it $3 trillion today, that this acquisition perhaps is one of the signals of when the stock starts not to as well? I have no clue. I'm just, it's kind of interesting.
You know, I hear
an
you.
Observation.
It's one of the largest mergers in history, but one of the interesting things about it is the best type of acquisitions tend to be bolt-ons and strategic acquisitions.
Yeah.
This is one of the largest mergers in history, but because Microsoft is so big, this is literally a bolt-on to them, right?
Yeah.
I think they'll probably do pretty well getting Activision and being able to use it to spur the Game Pass business and everything. I think they'll probably do pretty well. And by the way, if you look at how their peers have traded since Microsoft announced the deal, this is probably going to turn out to be a pretty shrewd deal, even without those synergies and stuff. But I think it'll do well, but it is an interesting thought. And to tie it back to the Microsoft thing, right now we're talking about, hey, this is going to be a great deal for them, right? Some of the deals Microsoft's done in the recent past have been great. 10 years ago, if you were like, Microsoft's going to do M&A, you and I would be like, oh, please don't. Microsoft, don't do it. Don't do another Nokia. You had to write the whole thing down. Like, it's just interesting how quickly fortunes can turn.
Yeah. Well, make a ton of money changes a lot of narratives. And, you know, I have talked to people that say, I'm just going to own it until Satya is gone. And I don't think that's the craziest thing in the world. I don't know that you...
Well, let me give you a counter.
I don't know that you can build a repeatable process on that, but I don't think that's the craziest thing in the world.
Let me give you a counter. Zuckerberg, right? Everybody...
Zuck.
In 2018, everybody said Zuck is the next Jobs. He's the next God. And if you rode that through 2021, it went really well for you. And then in 2022, he's investing $20 billion into the metaverse and the stock goes from 300 to 100. Would you have been able to say, hey, I ride with Zuckerberg? Some people did, but could you have? It looked like he was pretty delusional at the time, right? Like,
yeah. I did, but I didn't do it in size, so I can't like really pound my chest on it.
Narratives on CEOs can change pretty quickly, and you know, you get older. I know some investors who I really have a lot of respect for who I've probably lost respect for on a personal level, because they get very online and you start saying like, oh, hey, they're supporting anti-vax candidates. Like,
no, yeah, weird. Well, there's that.
That's not who I thought they were supporting. You know, Satya, things can change. Great CEOs from 10 years ago, the first Republic CEO until 4 months ago, we would have said he might be the best banker in the world. And now he doesn't look so hot.
Yes. Only Jamie Dimon is that. I don't disagree. Sometimes you shouldn't meet your heroes completely. That's my takeaway from some of the Twitter stuff that I've seen.
Jamie Dimon is pretty impressive. Like, the more I've looked at banks and you look at all the extra capital that JP Morgan's required to hold and just how good that business is and the returns they put on it, what he does is absolutely incredible.
Back in the day, somebody told me that my comp would be based upon us beating them in Chicago. And that was one of the things that I was like, all right, I'm out.
Good luck, sir.
Like, we're not, I think we're good, but we're not them. Can we talk some media? I didn't give you any prep for this.
Yeah.
What do we think? Speaking of narratives that are changing, Mr. Iger is kind of an interesting scenario Disney finds itself in.
Hey, he's another great example, right? 3 years ago, he retires. He goes off in the sunset. People say he might be the best media investor of all time.
Writes a book. People love the book.
People want him to retire. People want him to run for president. He comes back. Yeah, there were issues with his successor, but a lot of the issues that Disney is facing as a company are a direct result of the strategy Iger implemented while he was there and before he left. So talk about how
and identified a long, long time ago, right? On the ESPN call. And
well, the ESPN
has not pivoted.
Yeah, but I think there's
as much.
I 100% agree with you there, but I think a lot of the issues at Disney as a whole relate to, hey, the Marvel slate hasn't been that great recently. The Pixar slate, Pixar has not been that great lately. Like, Disney Plus doesn't have great content. They invested a lot of money into it. Like, ESPN's been in trouble, but everybody knew there was some issues there. Everything else isn't going great as well.
Guardians is excellent. Did you like it?
I liked it. I don't think I liked it as much as the consensus, but I did like it.
You don't like a love story about a fox? Or what is he? What is he ultimately?
He's a raccoon. Come on.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he is.
His name's
Rocky
Raccoon.
I'm sorry.
And he opens the little cage. I liked it, but it's not about my personal likes, right? Okay, they had Guardians. I've liked a lot of the Marvel TV shows. I haven't liked some of them, but the fact is the interest is waning. The storylines are messed up. Star Wars has been a disaster. Yes, Mandalorian's been great. I know people liked Andor, but they haven't done a movie in 4 or 5 years. And they, all of these things, they invested huge sums of money into them and the returns haven't been great. So the content strategy has been really tough there. And yeah, a lot of it reflects back on Iger. Media is just a really hard business.
So then we go to anything in like the Paramount WBD universe interest you or not really?
I was pretty bullish WBD when they made that deal. I thought there were big synergies. I thought HBO and Warner had been mismanaged under AT&T. I thought you got it under kind of Malone and Zaz, and I thought they'd be able to turn around. Absolutely horrific mismanagement there. It's just really hard. You know, one of the things with media is we talk about media like it's in a bubble, but media today, forget the cable bundle, they've got a lot of competition, right? You and I can go on Instagram and TikTok and pull up a ton of entertainment for free. Activision, for $70, you and I could go buy Call of Duty, and that would literally provide... We could play that for the rest of our lives if we wanted to. Like, media has a lot of competition. The competition for eyeballs is getting intense, and all of that's not going anywhere.
The craziest thing that is the most mind-blowing to me is I now no longer sub to Netflix. I don't sub to, well, I'm canceling HBO Max when my promo comes off. So we're basically on Hulu and the Disney bundle. And the reason that I'm canceling all this stuff is my kids just turn on YouTube.
Yep.
They want to watch people like you and I make, like, yesterday I'm watching a dad and his kid comment on a video game that's on autoplay. I made my kid turn it off, but like, this is what he wants to watch. And it's like billions of dollars are spent to entertain you and you want to watch this.
The hottest thing on YouTube apparently is like watching somebody go and play slots and just comment as they play slots, which I think is the most boring thing I've ever heard, but you know,
it's insane.
A lot of people like it.
Yeah. I sold almost all my media like 12 months ago, and I've determined that perhaps it's just too hard for me.
You know, an interesting thing about
on the competition, I think I've learned, and I probably could have just read Capital Returns and learned it anyway, but I think I've experienced it. Playing in areas that have increasing competition is not fun.
Yeah, that's one of the things I missed with cable in 2022. But another thing with media is a lot of the value traditionally has come from the library, and particularly over the past 3 years, right? Which is the library of, hey, we own 10,000 TV shows, and if you buy us, you can fill your back catalog with this so people can watch this, and maybe you can do some reboots of TV shows and stuff to get new characters and everything going. I know like Lionsgate has been a popular long, and a lot of people think that's the case. They look at what Amazon bought MGM for. And I think library in particular is just dead as having value. You know, having reruns of Cheers from the late 80s, I don't know how much value that has anymore. People aren't actively searching it out, and there's so much time. I don't think, maybe it's different for The Office and Parks and Rec, but I don't think people really want to go and watch old TV shows and have it on in the background, right? So they want to go watch the YouTube video, as you said. So that's just another area where it's something that had a lot of value for media companies historically. I don't think it has value anymore.
I think it's also tough when you have Netflix drops like 8 episodes in a row. It's almost like I feel like they're accelerating. On one hand, people will say, well, they should stretch it out. And I think that's not totally wrong to make the content spend more efficient. But I think every time they do it, it hurts the back catalog of everybody else, to your point, because there's only so many hours that you can fill in a day. And it's like, do you really want to go back? Even Seinfeld. I mean, I love Seinfeld. I would watch that back when cable, when it was in syndication, I'd watch every one. When it was on Netflix, I probably got through like 2 seasons, and then I was like, all right, I got other stuff to do, which is crazy to me.
I think that's a really astute point on the Netflix dropping everything. I mean, like, people have made this point. I just personally, I wish they didn't, because when they drop something, like, I like Stranger Things a lot, but if you drop all 10 episodes or 8 episodes, everybody binges it and you don't get the discussion. And one of the great things about a show like HBO is, you know, it comes on Sunday night and everybody can watch it together. And then you've got a whole week to discuss it with your friends and speculate about what's coming out next. And listen to you and I go on our up and coming Game of Thrones podcast, House of Brew, I think is what we're going to call it. But, you know, you can engage in that. Yeah. And when Stranger Things drops everything at once, you lose that engagement. And look, Netflix has done great. I have no opinion on the stock, but I do think they have to think about that, because name a brand outside of Stranger Things that they've done. Like, you know, they release all these buzzy TV shows, but everybody loses them. They never build any consciousness. And I think that's going to be an issue for them in the long term.
I think it's an easier problem to solve than the one that they have solved. But I agree with you that I think, I don't know, man, it's going to be really interesting. I don't know what Disney's going to end up doing. You know, one of the interesting things is you've got like a logical landing place for ESPN could be Comcast, but like Iger and Brian don't exactly have the friendliest history. There's a lot of stuff there, man. It's going to be interesting to watch.
Reed Hastings always said, hey, why will Netflix not have sports? And it's because, hey, the sports, we want to own our own things. If you go sports, like every year, they're just going to extract all the value for themselves, right? And ESPN's problem is the only thing that matters on them is the sports, and the sports leagues have plenty of bidders who are willing to pay really high dollars. And ESPN, to counter that, they've locked into really long-term contracts, and that works really well when you're getting $8 per month per sub. But when you have to get only like people who religiously watch sports, all of a sudden it's like, hey, ESPN, $50 per month. Nobody wants to pay that. It's in a really, really tough area. I think that a lot of, you know, those contracts with the leagues are debt. It's going to be really tough. I wouldn't be surprised if in the future, it's just every league has their own kind of bundle, except for maybe the NFL, who is just unique. But every league, if you're a basketball fan, you go and buy a basketball pass or something. I don't know, but they're in a tough spot.
Yeah. I don't know what that'll do to sports teams' valuations, because historically that has been one of the most bankable bets in the world. But I don't know. I've got some friends that are looking at Endeavor, and that kind of interests me, and kind of, I don't know, kind of doesn't at the same time. But on average, I'm interested.
Endeavor, it's Delic-like, right? They do that WWE merger, which I'm killing myself. I had such a big position in WWE for a long time. And then as happens in stocks, it like kind of did okay. And then all the return comes in like the last 3 months of it or something, right? And kind of missed those last 3 months. But Endeavor, yeah, the WWE merger is a killer. I think if you look at their ownership of WWE, it implies a very low price for the rest of the business. The issue there is people view it as a holdco, right? People view it as a controlled holdco, and they kind of question who the value is going to flow to, the shareholders or the management team.
Yeah, that would be the pushback.
Yeah, but it's interesting. They've got a lot of great assets, and also what they've done with the assets has been absolutely spectacular.
Yeah. That's kind of an interesting. Have you seen a scenario where that kind of holdco really works? Or, I mean, do you have any idea the base rates of these kind of things?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think people would point to IAC and Liberty as ones where it's worked, though on both of them, I would say, what have you done for me lately? And I would say, what have you done for them lately, for both them, particularly Liberty? I don't know. I do think most of them probably end up substantially underperforming because incentives rule the day. And for most controlled holdcos, the history is your incentive is take the money for yourself and don't give it to shareholders. And if you and I, we can point to successes, but there's probably confirmation bias there or selection bias, right? Because the successes are obvious and the failures kind of linger away on the pink sheets while the managements continue to pay themselves huge salary until they go BK.
Yeah. Liberty is interesting. I think you and I have slightly different takes on this. I think what they've done with the Braves and how they've supported that organization is incredible. Formula One, I think, is incredible. Curate, I think, is hard to judge now because it's kind of it's like a mature asset. I think they're better at I think their sweet spot is doing a deal and then injecting the growth capital or someone that can grow it. I think once the business kind of gets mature, I don't know how much value can a holdco actually add at that point? But maybe the answer is they should get out of it earlier.
This is IAC's thing where they say, hey, we grow it till it's mature and then we spin it, right? But okay, you say Liberty has done well. Formula One, they had to bail Formula One out at the height of the crisis because they mismanaged Formula One's capital structure, right? Liberty Sirius had to bail them out.
Maybe. I mean, it was a pandemic, but facts are the facts, but I think there's nuance around here, but
completely fine, but they had to bail them out. Just kind of hand waving and saying, oh, Curate was a mature asset. They owned that asset for 30 years, you know, and they did maintain the leverage. They bought back tons of shares at 20. You know, I particularly remember in 2021, I think it was, when Malone was asked, what's your favorite asset in your complex? And he said, Curate, and the stock went down 80%. And part of that was the fire. But, you know, it was very clear that Curate had huge issues as the cable bundle unwound. And he was just very married to, there's a lot of cash flow here. You go over to Glibba. Glibba bungled their cap structure. Not in the way Formula One did, but they bought back as many shares as they could when Charter's at 700 or 800. And then now they can't buy back shares as aggressively because they've got some debt coming due. Curate, there's lots of little self-dealings between lots of things, right? Curate needs cash. They've got a ComScore position. Glibba buys the ComScore position from. I just think there's a lot of questions. This is outside of Maffei's land, but you look at Liberty Global, you look at Lilac. Formula One's a home run. Atlanta Braves has done really well. But I think when you look at the all-encompassing Liberty, I think they've actually actively destroyed value over the past couple of years.
Well, I guess that the only counter that I would say with them is you do know what you get for the most part with them.
I mean, what do I get?
As far as levered capital structures,
$50 million per year to Greg Maffei to Greg Maffei, David Zaslav, and Mike Freeze for way below market returns.
Do you remember when that woman asked Greg to fire Zaslav? That was hilarious.
It would have been a good thing. But you know, I don't know. I certainly hear you, but Liberty Sirius, right? Liberty Sirius.
I have egg on my face over Curate too, because I was not saying pay down debt. Skelecap, he was saying pay down debt. I did not foresee the changes, but I the reason I can't own it now is I just don't understand the customer. You know, 2020, Mike says these cohorts are acting just like the rest. To me, that's like, okay, let's go. And now if you look at the top line, the customer counts are way down, and that is not like it is historically. And until I could answer that question, it's too hard. for me.
I was in Qurate for a while. I did not do as well as you guys who like bought it in late 2020 and got the press and flipped it and everything. But
I wore it on the way down, man. I got out at pretty close to break even.
To me, the question with Qurate has always been, back to the media question, the return on time, right? And for a long time, I thought it was, oh, you've got these middle-aged women who have formed real relationships with the hosts. And that was a real thing. And they tuned in and it was their daily ritual. But, you know, you can get that on TikTok and you can get in a more aggressive form with probably better data and a host who's willing to be more entrepreneurial and more responding. And you can buy stuff that you actually want. It's just a tough business, man. All their distribution. Tough.
Well, the other thing that I think that David Rawlinson has the right idea here, but my perception of what's going on is they devalued that daily deal a little bit. And once you devalue that, like, then you kind of come, like, what are you coming for? Right. So I think they're getting back to some of their roots. I root for them. I hope they work, but I will not have an economic interest in the outcome.
But yeah, look, that's just another one. It's liberty controlled. I guess it's not technically liberty, but it's obviously liberty controlled and completely bungled. You look at them, Liberty Sirius is the highlight to me. They do self-dealing where they bail out Formula One. They do that rights offering. They swap Berkshire shares of Siri for Liberty Sirius. Why? Like, why did they do that?
Yeah, that I didn't fully understand.
And they've been saying for years, we're going to buy back shares. We're going to take advantage of this discount. They don't buy back shares that aggressively. They've never done anything. And maybe it will work, but I'm sure it will work. One day they will collapse it. Maybe they collapse it now that the Braves have been spun, but they've cost shareholders a lot of value by waiting this long, and they've cost me a lot of alpha by waiting this long.
Well, hopefully they do close it, and those that have been patient are rewarded. We'll see. It's
been incentives, right? Like, Greg, every year he doesn't close it, he gets another $20 million. So for him, when he says, hey, we'll take our time and we'll buy back shares, yeah, I'm sure, but you'll also keep cashing $20 million checks while you're doing it.
Well, So I'm not trying to defend that, but I think that that's common. One thing that just, like, when Iger got his little pay bump, I was like, you really need that? I don't know. As a society, we're like pretty comfortable with this now. You know, and it's upsetting.
If I was in the situation, I'm sure I would want to be paid, particularly if I thought I was. But for me, it's like, I guess I'm just disappointed because Malone still controls Liberty. And I think Greg has just done an objectively poor job. And he gets paid a lot of money. And I don't see, like, these are holdcos. He's not even operating. He gets paid a lot of money. And I don't even see him creating value at the holdcos. It is kind of tough. At least Iger is going and making sure, like, we get Guardians of the Galaxy 3, or we're going to get, you know, Avengers 4 at some point and all that. So just tough.
Yeah. I go back to, I think they've done a good job in the growthy part of the assets. But I think when they get mature, I think there's some legitimate complaints. So we'll see. I don't know. Maybe we can get Shane on here and I can hit her with some of these questions.
Yeah, I feel bad. I like the people there. I like Shane. I would love to get back involved, but every month the stock goes down and I see more bad deals and more self-dealing and the results aren't there. I'm like, oh, this is why you don't want to be involved in these things anymore.
Well, something I think is legit is if you make that much and you put a target on your back, there is an expectation that it works. And if it doesn't work, you're going to get criticized, right? That's just how it works.
Yeah.
What about RideQ? You want to go through that real quick and then I'll let you out of here?
This is a fun one. So everybody should know I've got a small position in it. It's a bankrupt company. So people should just be very aware of, obviously that carries tons of extra risk, but this is a really interesting one. RideQ is still Lordstown Motors.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
When you go out to dinner with your friends and they say, what do you invest in? And you say, I have an investment in a bankrupt company. Do they understand what you're talking about, or do they shudder a little bit?
The only one, Twitter last year. Everybody wanted to talk about Twitter when Twitter was happening.
That's fair. That's fair. All right. Continue. But, sorry. So
Lordstown, you know, it is this peak SPAC bubble EV mania. They come public. They top out at a $6 billion valuation. And then it all falls apart. And it all doesn't fall apart just because it's overvalued. It all falls apart because there's this famous, you know, the CEO says, we've got enough orders, like firm orders to fund us all the way through production in 2023. And then a few months later, they fire the CEO and they say, look, it really depends on what your definition of firm orders is. You know, if you believe firm orders are like written contracts, then no, we didn't have those. But if you believe firm orders are somebody said, hey, yeah, if you can deliver this car on time and on budget, we'd consider buying it, then that is a firm order. And we've
an indication of interest is a firm order.
So the company, they buy, you know, they had bought an old GM plant for that was worth quite a bit of money. So they've got all these things. The company is just absolutely dissolving under the weight of this, you know, I don't want to say fraud, but a lot of crazy stuff. 2021, they say, hey, let's pivot. We're going to have the brand, but we're going to figure out we can't be this capital heavy because we can't raise money anymore. So they sell their plant and a lot of their, they sell their plant and most of their production capabilities to Foxconn, and they form a JV with Foxconn, and Foxconn's going to do all that. And 2022 comes and Foxconn says, we're kind of not sure that this, and at the end of 2022, Foxconn strikes an agreement. All right, we're going to cancel the JV. And instead, let's just make this simple. Foxconn's going to give you guys $200 million. Foxconn will do the operations. You guys will do kind of the design and everything. And that'll be the thing. Foxconn, you know, they make Apple phones. They know how to manufacture. They manufacture, they give you cash, you do the funding. And that's how we're going to do this. And 2023, the stock dip. They get a NASDAQ notice that says, hey, you guys are trading under $1 per share. You need to get over $1 per share or else we will delist you. And Foxconn is way underwater on their investment at this point. And Foxconn says, hey, our investment requires you to be listed. You got a delisting notice. Hmm. We're not going to do this. We're not going to fund you anymore. And Lordstown says, no, this is just a delisting notice. We can cure this. We're going to do a reverse split to cure this. They reverse split. Well, every partner that Lordstown is talking to, Lordstown has to file the 8K that says Foxconn says they're not going to fund us anymore and they're not taking this back. Every partner says, hey, forget about this. You guys don't have a business without Foxconn. So Lordstown goes and files for bankruptcy kind of at the end of June. And it's a really unique bankruptcy because Lordstown, they're not filing for bankruptcy because they have debt. They have zero debt. They have about $10 per share in cash on their balance sheet. So they are a cash-heavy company filing for bankruptcy, and they're doing it because, one, Foxconn has blown up their business, and they are still burning cash, you know, paying engineers to design their cars and everything. And B, from the old, hey, it depends on what your definition of orders days is, they have a ton of shareholder fraud litigation outstanding, right? So they've got unknown liabilities, a cash-burning business, and their funding has just gone and pulled itself away. So they file for bankruptcy. And they sue Foxconn and say, Foxconn, you caused this bankruptcy. You owe us this money. And that's the basic situation. You know, as you and I are talking, the stock trades for about $3 per share. It's up a little bit from where I kind of first wrote it up and first started investing in it. But it's a really interesting situation where, hey, if they could just liquidate right now, you would get more than your money worth. They have a downside of zero where, you know, if bankruptcy costs run crazy or if they have to pay insane amounts for these shareholder fraud suits, then yeah, it could be a zero. But on the upside, they can rightly say, hey, Foxconn, you were supposed to invest up to $200 million in us and you pulled back. So we lost our entire business. You owe us that money plus damages. And if that happened, you know, you could see massive, massive upside here. And there's other things, but I've kind of rambled and done, I think, a nice job of laying out the whole situation. And I'll talk about any piece of it you want to.
I honestly don't know enough about it to have an informed conversation, but I think it's a good example of like the type of thing that you turn over. And to the extent that I have a listener base that may not listen to your stuff or read your stuff, I think that they should check you out.
They should fix that.
Know the OG of blogging.
We mentioned N of ones before, and this to me is very close to an N of one where A, you had a company filing for bankruptcy with over $100 million of cash on their balance sheet, no debt, right? So you've got a business filing for bankruptcy, not because they're overlevered, but because they've got unknown liabilities and their key funder just destroyed their business. So that's one. B, it, you know, at $2 per share, they have 16 million shares outstanding. It was about a 30 million market cap, and they've got $1 billion of NOLs from, you know, running a kind of questionable business. Because of that, they put in a NOL cap that says you can't own more than 4.5%. So the most you could buy was about $1 million. So you've got this business with no debt, microcap filing for bankruptcy. There's no distressed guy who could really look at this thing. It's an N of one. We've never seen a situation like this before.
And what's the volume on something like this? Like, how do you even get?
The volume is pretty crazy because it was still a former meme stock, and it has dried up a little bit now that it's gone from ride to ride Q, and it's not like traded on the big exchanges and stuff, but the volume was pretty wild. I mean,
interesting. So you could get in a reasonable size.
absolutely you could get in a reasonable size. The issue was you had to stay under the NOL limit. So, you know, I'd have friends who would have bankruptcy experience. I'd say, hey, take a look at this. What do you think? And they say, oh, I can't. Like, the most I could get is $1 million position. There's no bonds for me to invest in. You know, like a Garrett, you could at least buy hundreds of millions of bonds or something when you were getting this. This, there was nothing really to look at.
Interesting. So that might be your edge, right? The ability to do it.
The edge, you know, for what would be a very small position, I spent a lot of time looking at the bankruptcy docket. So maybe the return on brain damage isn't going to be great, but I think it's that, the complete uniqueness of the situation, actually reading the docket, you know, I think those were it.
Well, you say that, but we've talked about, you know, a model that you're working on a legal aspect to your investing, right? So it's an arrow in your quiver or whatever, your arrow. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say here, but I bet you're going to compound your knowledge over time, and maybe this is a high return on brain damage, but it'll save you time in the future.
I think so. And I've done bankruptcies in the past. Like, I had Garrett, and there was an old one, Rate Q, where I served on the creditor committee for a while. But I do think legal situations in investing, and maybe this is just because they've worked out so spectacularly over the past year, but if you look at like Twitter, if you look at
Sotera,
Garrett would have been, Sotera is a great one. Burford recently, Liquidia is still early days, but I do think legal situations in investing have been underfollowed and have generated tons of alpha. And yeah, there have been ones in the past that have failed, but recently they've been really good. And the world feels like it's getting more litigious, and those type of quirky things, I think, are an area investors can really look at for edge.
There you have it. Sir, I want to thank you for stopping by.
Yeah. Hey, how many people have done two of these?
Not many.
I'm in a unique, exclusive club. I love it.
You are indeed. It's going to get less exclusive. I regret to inform you, but, I don't know, man. The curation of guests, I like to talk to you, right? So why would I not want to do another pod? I kind of want to have like repeat guests over the years. That's kind of what I want this show to be. I don't want this show to always be like new people.
That's fun. See how people are evolving. And yeah, I can't even remember what we talked about because the first one we did was in the pandemic and I've blacked everything.
Oh, it was, I'm almost certain.
SPACs. It was definitely SPACs, right?
Yeah. And I think you rang the bell on This Is Crazy. I remember you were very anxious to get it out.
I miss SPACs because
they
were the greatest speculation vehicle of all time because you could buy them at 10, you would get $10 per share in cash back, and there was the chance that they would announce an electric vehicle deal and it would go to 60. And with the benefit of hindsight, I was doing these in very small size and I should have been doing them in incredibly large size because it's like, hey,
I don't know, man. I don't know.
That type of situation, you know, how many things can you actually say, hey, unless JP Morgan is lying to me about the trust account, my downside is literally zero.
Yeah. You're right.
So, you know, I was doing them. I think you could have risked funds on them and you could have been up. If you had sold them smartly, you could have been up 400% in 3 months and you would have taken no risk. The issue I actually ran into, and this is one I run into a lot, you know, the stock would go from 10 to 10.50 and be like, I'm out. And then it would go from 10.50 to 60. So I wasn't the one to ride it all the way up. But
you didn't ride DWAC the entire way up?
I actually tried to buy a little DWAC the morning that deal got announced pre-market. I think it was trading at like 11.50. And I was like, no, I won't pay more than 10% of trust, 11. And that never got hit. And 3 hours later, it was trading for $100 per share. And I was like, okay, well, my trading skills suck.
That thing was wild. I do understand what you're saying. If you can buy them below trust and you have a sponsor that can get something flashy done, especially at that time, that made some sense. Ah, the world with Chamath or whatever. What a
great
time.
For a while, man. You could buy those things. Look, a lot of people made money in IPOA, right? It IPO'd early pandemic or right before pandemic, but people said, this is the best investment I can find. Chamath is going to pump the shit out of whatever he does.
Yeah,
and
except for his legs.
It's trading below trust. So heads, I redeem for trust and I'll make like a cash-like return. Tails, it goes parabolic and I make incredible returns in a very short time frame.
Yeah. Ah, man. I don't know. It's sad what happened to retail. Sad what still happens in some circles. I don't know, man. I see some of these spaces restarting on Twitter and look at some of the ETFs that are associated, and it doesn't make me too happy. But what can I do? That's for other people to monitor, not me.
Yeah, I hear that.
All right, my dude, we'll talk soon.
Cool. Hey, this is great. Thanks for having me on again. It's been really fun. It's always fun to ramble for 90 minutes.
Indeed. Well, it's always fun to listen to you ramble for another 90 minutes. I hear it weekly, but it's nice to be a part of the rambling.
Thanks, man.
Maybe someday I'll have another idea and I'll come on and pitch.
I've invited you. You just got to have an idea.
Well, that's the hard part, my man. All right. We'll talk soon.
Sounds good.